stand on guard for thee.
Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. I am Tim Elliott, and I have with me tonight Nigel Spink.
Ohayo gozaimasu. Good morning here from Japan.
Ah. It is just going to be the two of us tonight, I believe, because we have some of the other Third Degree Burn crew that are unavailable. Some may pop on, some may not.
Okay, so yep. Open door.
It's open door for whoever wants to come in for us.
Yeah. But,
and today we are going to be continuing our run-up to Alpha Flight. We have recorded a couple of, we've done previously X-Men 109. X-Men 120, 121, and tonight we're going to be covering X-Men 139 and 140 before we get into Alpha Flight proper, and we'll cover that sequentially. So tonight I have X-Men 139, and I think Nigel is going to be covering X-Men 140.
That's right.
Is there any news or anything, Nigel, before we kind of get started? I know...
Other than it's kind of personal news, it's nothing to do with what we're looking at tonight, but I've been quite amazed by how many people have suddenly found my Facebook page, Marvel in the 1980s.
Nice.
The membership has grown massively in a matter of about 1 month. About a month ago, we had round about 82 members. And now got, 2,000 or just over. they're just joining, it seems they're just joining every minute of every day at the moment.
Well,
So that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. Our Facebook, I haven't looked lately, but I think we're knocking on 1,000 members.
I think it was 930 yesterday.
Yeah.
930, yeah.
So that helps.
Yeah.
That helps gets the show out because when we post. Somebody just joined. I think Kirk is going to join us.
What's our topic today?
X-Men. Did you not do your homework, Kirk?
No, I didn't. I'm not presenting. You guys have 139 and 140. Is that right?
That's correct. Right.
Okay. You want me to bring you in since you guys are doing the heavy lifting?
Well, I've already brought us in. I'm just going to kind of cut this part out.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No. Don't apologize. we were just kind of getting started, so I'll cut this, edit this part out with all this mic problems, and then I'll bring us back in. I'll say, okay, sorry, we had a technical problem, but we're now we're joined by Kirk Greenfield, and we'll just go on from there. How's that sound? Okay.
That's fine.
Cool. All right. You ready, Kirk?
I'm ready.
All right. And we'll go in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back. We had a small technical problem there, but we have that solved, and we are now joined by Kirk Greenfield.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So Kirk is going to lend us his X-Men expertise as we discuss these two issues. I think we can go ahead and get started. I did, Nigel and I were talking off air. I did, since we are doing our road to Alpha Flight, as I'm calling it, I have a little timeline that I put together that lists all of their appearances from their first up to Alpha Flight 1. Now, some of these we've covered because they are burn related. Some are not, so I'm just mentioning them here. And then I have a short synopsis for one of them because Byrne was the co-writer on a Hulk annual. So these are the Alpha Flight appearances. Of course, we've covered X-Men 109, which is November 77. And that was just Weapon Alpha, who would later become Vindicator. Well, then we did X-Men 120, 121, which is January through February of 79. And that introduced Alpha Flight proper, Vindicator, Sasquatch, Snowbird, Shaman, Northstar, and Aurora. Then there's Hulk Annual number 8 from August 1979. And this is the one that was co-written by John Byrne with Roger Stern. And this was features Sasquatch only. Then there's Machine Man number 18, which is September 1980, which has Sasquatch, Northstar, and Aurora. And that kind of ties in with Nigel's book. Then there's X-Men 139, 140 we're covering today, which is August through September 1980, which just has Vindicator, Shaman, and Snowbird. Then Marvel 2-in-1 number 84 from October 1981, which features Vindicator, Shaman, Sasquatch, Aurora and Northstar. And then there's Incredible Hulk number 277 through 279 from August to October 1982, which features Vindicator, Sasquatch, Snowbird, Shaman, Northstar, and Aurora. And then that leads right up into Alpha Flight number 1, which is May 1983. So I'm going to read a short synopsis for the Hulk annual that John Byrne co-wrote, because it takes place in between X-Men 120 and the books we're going to cover now, 139. And this, like I said, this is Roger Stern, John Byrne are the writers. The artist is Sal Buscema. And it's Incredible Hulk Annual number 8, entitled Sasquatch. Hulk was sent flying through the skies by the power of Machine Man, and he crashed in northeastern British Columbia. After feeling the shock from the impact, a nearby woman named Marine Moores Friesen went outside to see what happened. She found the Hulk with his head buried, and she tried to help him so he wouldn't suffocate. When Hulk wakes up, he sees her and thinks she is an enemy, but the girl explains to him what happened, and Hulk calls her a friend. He takes Moore to her home, where Hulk calmed down and became Dr. Bruce Banner. In the meantime, the Canadian Army is trying to find someone to fight the Hulk, but the only active member of Alpha Flight is Sasquatch. After a conversation, they call him. When Dr. Mankowski learns the situation, he's excited to see who is more powerful, Hulk or Sasquatch, and he accepts the mission. At the arrival point, he transforms and lands in the area. Marine, after a conversation with Dr. Banner, has gone out. After some time, Bruce Banner heard a scream, and he goes out with a shotgun to find Moores at the hands of Sasquatch. When Bruce calms down, he tries to communicate with Sasquatch, but Dr. Lankowski wants Hulk, so he tried to enrage him by pushing him off a cliff. After that, the two monsters fight each other. From their battle, a rocky avalanche starts, and Moores are in its way. Sasquatch is trying to save her when Hulk thinks he wants to attack her. When the avalanche stops, Sasquatch pops out from the ground, with the girl seeing that the area is destroyed because of him. When the Hulk becomes enraged and wants to kill Sasquatch, but he stops and flees when he sees the scared face of the girl. That's it. I didn't write that. I got that right off the wiki. That's a very awkward synopsis. Anyway, so that was written by Stern and Byrne.
Generally, now, very good friends and very good creators. They do the best.
Yeah, I think they like working together a lot.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now we're going to get into our issues proper. And I have X-Men 139. Okay. Our writer, Chris Claremont, John Byrne. I think Byrne's listed as a plotter. Our artist is John Byrne. Our anchor is Terry Austin. Our colorist is Glynis Wayne. Our letterer is Tom Orzganowski. Our cover art is John Byrne and Terry Austin. Our editor is Louise Jones. And our editor-in-chief is Jim Shooter. This had a release date of August 19, 1980, with a cover date of November 1980. The only other Byrne book at the same time was Captain America 251, Mercenary and the Madman, and he was a penciler on that only. Uncanny X-Men 139, titled Something Wicked This Way Comes. The X-Men participate in a grueling session in the Danger Room. As Angel, Colossus, Storm, and Nightcrawler go through their exercises, Professor X and Kitty Pryde witness the spectacle from the room's monitoring station. Kitty is terrified to see the degree of danger that she may one day have to face. As the session ends, the team regroups and they decide to officially welcome Kitty to the team. When Nightcrawler appears in a doorway, she is instinctively frightened by his appearance and feels bad for acting that way. When the professor decides it's time that Kitty take up a code name, he suggests the name Ariel. She doesn't like it and chooses Sprite instead. When Nightcrawler inquires why Wolverine changed his costume, he replies that he just felt like it. Wolverine approaches the professor and asks if he can go up to Canada and straighten out things with the Canadian government. The professor agrees that this is a good idea, and Nightcrawler asks to go along, hoping to meet Aurora again. That's reference to X-Men 120-121. Storm and Kitty leave the mansion for the streets of Salem Center. Aurora brings her to a dance studio owned by famed dance instructor Stevie Hunter. Kitty is excited to begin taking classes and feels that the physical exercise will help her balance out all of the mental challenges that the school might throw at her. Later, Wolverine and Nightcrawler arrive in Canada. Meet with Heather McNeil Hudson, wife of Department H's James Hudson, formerly known as Weapon Alpha, now calling himself Vindicator. James arrives shortly after and prepares to settle affairs with Wolverine. Their past animosity has to be tabled, however, as more pressing matters are brought to the forefront. In Ottawa, Ontario, the capital of Canada, Heather Hudson comes home to find intruders in her home. Grabbing a broom, she gets the drop on them and is surprised to see that it is Wolverine. When she calls him Logan, Nightcrawler asks why Wolverine never told anyone his real name. Wolverine comments that no one bothered to ask. When Logan gets down to business, he asks Heather where James is. She tells him that he's up in the Hudson Bay area investigating something with Alpha Flight on behalf of Department H. Up in Hudson Bay, Vindicator returns to the cabin where Alpha Flight has stationed themselves on this mission. With Aurora, Northstar, and Sasquatch on another mission, see Machine Man number 18, James only has Shaman and Snowboard with him. As they go over the maps of the area, Shaman's mystical alarms go off and Alpha Flight prepares for an attack. Turns out only to be Wolverine and Nightcrawler, who offered their help. Vindicator is happy to see Logan and explains that they are out searching for a family that was attacked by the Wendigo. While the son managed to escape, the father was killed, but the mother and her baby child might still be alive in the wilderness. Wolverine recalls his previous encounter with Wendigo and believes that if anyone can stop the beast, it's him. Wolverine sends Nightcrawler out to the Jeep to get their gear. As the sun sets, Nightcrawler's thoughts think about how Jean Grey had died in battle and curses of fate for being so cruel. Hearing something coming up from behind him fast, Nightcrawler turns and is horrified to find that the Wendigo has come up behind him. To be continued. That is our setup issue. This issue has a lot of setup.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And nice cliffhanger ending there.
Oh, absolutely. It's a
scary.
It's a bang. Yeah, it is. And I love the way...
I wasn't familiar with Wendigo prior to this. And so when he says Wendigo on the last page, I was kind of, I was flipping through this on the shelf at the bookseller and on the news seller during college. So I wasn't paying a lot of attention. I wasn't buying Marvel Comics. I wasn't buying the X-Men, but I kind of was watching this great artwork go past. It would be another, I don't know, 3-4 months. Once I graduated with my master's, before I found out I had free time on my hand and began to start buying issues. So more's the pity. But I just didn't catch what Wendigo was or why he was saying.
I wasn't real. I mean, I knew of him from being a character in the introduction of Wolverine, Hulk 181. But I don't think he'd made a lot of appearances. I don't think he makes a lot of appearances in Marvel. But this is... apparently, the Wendigo in this story... Well, I'll leave that till we cover your issue, Nigel. I don't want to...
Okay, well, I was going to say, I think he first appeared before the story with Wolverine in. That was his second appearance, I think, in the Hulk.
Yeah.
I think he'd appeared for the first time earlier. I can't remember much about the story, but basically it was just like a battle between the Hulk and... Wendigo, and something to do with mystic powers that had turned, you know. Oh, yeah, that's right, because the secret of the Wendigo, if you like, not the secret, but the curse is that if you eat human flesh, you become the Wendigo.
Yeah.
And I think the original, the first person who did that, was the first Wendigo. Yeah. But, yeah, he didn't appear a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and apparently they're... is an actual, from my little bit of research, something called Wendigo psychosis, which is a real thing. The symptoms are...
into Wendigo.
No, but the symptoms are you have an overwhelming desire or urge to consume human flesh. Wendigo is kind of a mythical creature that you see in a lot of its Native American... lore.
Yeah.
And I think they all have to do with cannibalism. So it's kind of a curse that if you succumb to that, then you become the Wendigo. You're invaded by the evil spirit that is the Wendigo. And what's kind of overlooked by this issue, this story is that this is it's not our introduction to Kitty, but it's her introduction as an X-Man. Mm. You see her in costume, because she was introduced back in 129, and this is her, and I did a little research on that, and her name comes from, we probably mentioned this before in the show, her name comes from an actual person that John Byrne knew in art school, that he asked her if he could use her name, and she had no problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the fact, apparently she was an artist herself, and when she wanted to create her own website, she couldn't get any kind of domain name with Kitty Pryde because they were all taken up by Marvel fans.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the name became so famous. So, and so I don't know how created, you know, but she was supposed to be, I guess, Shooter had asked for them to create a second team that would be students, because obviously the new X-Men are too old to be students. And she was going to be the first of that. And then that fell through, but then later came back as the New Mutants. So that's why we get her, her brought in as kind of a student. Yeah.
Say was the first, was supposed to be the first of them. Was that Kitty?
That's Kitty. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the new team just fell through. They kept Kitty. And then later, obviously after Byrne left the book, Claremont created the New Mutants. So it is, if you want to, you know, if you wanted to, I think the professor still sometimes refers to them as students, but, you know, they're all adults. So not like the original X-Men who were starting out as teens. And, you know, these are obviously, I mean, so we kind of get that with Kitty. So we get a chance to kind of see stuff through her eyes. And that's what, you know, so again, I think part of this issue is overshadowed by the fact that we get her introduction. She always has this kind of bond with Aurora, which kind of, she feels threatened when they go to Stevie's dance studio. Aurora feels a little threatened by the way those two hit it off pretty good. And I think this Stevie Hunter is a character that I think I was first introduced to. I think she shows up in the graphic novel God Loves, Man Kills, because there's a scene where Kitty is going to, she's on the street with her or something. I think she's in that book.
Mm-hmm.
But
this is her first appearance, is it not?
Correct. Yeah. That's her. Yeah.
139. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're getting hints at, well, a lot of this first part of this issue is a lot of, which I think what the X-Men did so well was you get a lot of character development. I mean, you get a great danger room scene, which is fun. You get, some stuff going on between Nightcrawler and Kitty. He knows he kind of scares her and she feels bad about his appearance. You get, I think, hints of what will become the Kitty Colossus romance later on. And then, you know, then it splits. You've got Kitty kind of doing her thing. And then you've got the stuff in Canada with Alpha Flight and Heather, and then Wolverine going up there to meet them. In Ottawa at their house, which I looked up that address that's in this book, which is 138A L'Oreal Drive. And I think it must be there's a real street, L'Oreal Avenue, but it looks like what he's drawn. So he must be drawing from his own personal knowledge of the city, because that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Not unusual for Byrne to use real buildings in his model, particularly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're buildings of friends or houses. There's a couple of famous examples where, as a thank you for a Comic-Con coordinator, he put that house in the beginning of something in the New Universe series. And he sprinkles it in just as a little nod to his friends. Doesn't identify who they are, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, Nigel, I'm doing a lot of talking. What did you think?
Well, I was just going to say the artwork at this time.
It's gorgeous.
It's fabulous. Yeah. I mean, just looking through it as you were doing the synopsis, and just about every page is like, oh yeah, that's really nice artwork. And as you were just saying, the storylines and the characterizations and were just rolling along. They were really good at this time. they really, you know, they were really working well together. Or so we thought, Claremont and Byrne. It seemed like everything in the garden was nice and rosy. It certainly looked that way from, you know, just reading the comic anyway. Yeah, some really nice pictures. I noticed one thing I found interesting. Where is it? Oh, something about Wolverine. Well, I've lost it now. What was it? Ah, this happens every time when I don't write it down. Oh, yeah. when Heather mentions Logan by name, and Nightcrawler says, "Is that your name?" And he says, "Yeah, and you never told us." And he says, "You never asked." That's exactly the same answer as he gave in X-Men 118 when Cyclops says, "I didn't know you could read Japanese."
Yep.
And Wolverine said, "You never asked." So that's his answer to everything that surprises anybody. You never asked.
Well, that's funny because we learned, and I don't know if it was the first time, but in when he tells Mirko that his name is Logan. So as the reader, we find out that's his name. But this is when the X-Men, I guess,
find out
that that's his name. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this
dropped earlier, the Elf, when they were doing the Black Tom. Was it Black Tom and Juggernaut? Says, "Okay, Mr. Logan," and you don't know if it's first name, last name. I think that's the first time it's dropped.
It may be, yeah. Mm-hmm. You think they would be. But, and there's a, where's the other, I thought this was funny, when Kitty's talking about her name, which I didn't, I knew she was Sprite and then Ariel. Oh. I didn't know that they suggested Ariel first. She didn't like it. And then she went with Sprite, and she makes the comment, "I better not hear any cracks about people pulling my tab," which is, that's a little outdated because you don't pull tabs anymore.
Right. But
tab was also a diet drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, made by the same company. Yeah. Sprite, Coca-Cola made Sprite or made tab. And then what else we got? Then we've got, kind of just like I said, it's a lot of setup. Get more with them.
I always liked the danger room scenes, though, even right back in the original X-Men. I used to like it when they did a danger room scenario. Yeah, of course, these are a lot more elaborate with all the characters there. Because in the original X-Men, they tended to go one at a time. You know, first it were Beast's test, and then it were Angel's test, etc. Now they're all just flying around, attacking things or dodging things. You know,
I wonder if that's more done for the artist, because I'm sure in the script the writer just says, "Give me 3 or 4 pages of Danger Room," and they can draw whatever they want, action. And then he'll just fill in the. And it's always something's gone wrong, so we have to somehow tear up the danger room because something didn't go right.
The bit where Nightcrawler's falling, though, after Angel and he collide, I always think, I don't think Wolverine would have had time to actually do that.
No.
And pick up the piece of wall and get it underneath him. To catch him before he reached the flames. Yeah. It's got to be, you've got to imagine that he's ripping his claws through the wall, probably at the same time as Angel and Nightcrawler first hit one another.
Yeah. Well, you think he would time it. He would do more like he would jump across and grab Nightcrawler and, you know, carry him further past the flames. Yeah. Because you think, why is he not teleporting? But I guess he's stunned.
He's Angel says that. Yeah, he's not teleporting. So maybe he's a bit unconscious. So that's fair enough. And then he does, after Wolverine saves him, he does bamf out of there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And right into the way of Colossus, who's throwing a big robot his way. Just bad timing. Yeah.
And that robot, let's talk about the cover here a little bit. The cover is a segmented cover with Kitty Pryde in the middle, and it says, "Welcome to the X-Men, Kitty Pryde. Hope you survive the experience." And it's got panels, of stuff that's going on in the issue. The one on the left, which is two of them are Danger Room scenes. One of them is Colossus fighting the robot, and Angel is dodging these cylinders that are coming at him. That robot's face, for some reason, looks a little bit like Box.
Yes.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But in the story proper, it doesn't necessarily look like, you don't really get a good look at it. It kind of does a little bit, maybe.
You see it from behind first, and then, upside down. But if you turn the page upside down,
Yeah, it looks a little like it.
It looks pretty much the same, yeah. It looks boxish on the face anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
And
I like the we learn in this, obviously, that Aurora now is the team leader because Cyclops left in the previous issue. And Wolverine calls Professor X, calls him Charlie, and he's kind of, and Professor X kind of chides him on it. He says, "Don't call me that."
His
response is, "Sure, Chuck."
Yeah, we're going to say, I like that. He says, "Call me Professor, Professor X, Professor Xavier, even Charles if you must, but not Charlie." And then he goes, "Sure, Chuck." It's like Charlie Brown, isn't it?
Yep.
Chuck. I like that. And then Xavier's thought bubble in response to that is just like a black scribble.
It's just like that dark cloud, you know. I did want to ask on, because we get set up.
I like the picture with Nightcrawler swinging in with the lemonade.
I think that's one they use in Ohatmu, an image of showing his dexterity, because he's got his feet. His feet are clamped to the door frame.
And Kitty's still a bit wary of him. She's seems frightened by his appearance. But all good and all nicely illustrated, of course.
It's that opening splash with the Angel. You've got all these cylinders coming at him. Is just top notch, and then you've got a great big 2-page splash with all of them in in the Danger Room.
Yeah, on that splash page, the first one with the title on it. Yeah, I always feel that I remember the first time I looked at it, I thought somebody else inked this, because I think I remember looking up just to check that it is Terry Austin who's the inker. Which it is, but it looks a bit, I don't know, it looks a bit simpler than a lot of the other work inside, if that's the right word to use. But
not as much detail in the background.
Well, there's not a lot of background really, is there? But there's just something about the Angel's.
I think it's the wings. His wings are a little not as detailed.
Could be that.
I don't know if
I mean, it's still a nice picture. And the cylinder's coming up, so because you're like, you've got the perspective of the
that's what sells it.
They're coming towards you. And then that's the second and third page double splash is nice.
And I wanted to ask, because we get kind of out of that and we get into Canada. This is the first time I think we get some dialogue from Snowbird. I don't believe we had anything from her in issue 120, 121. We saw her in action, but I don't think we saw any dialogue. And compare this to the way Byrne will write her in Alpha Flight. And I think her personality has changed a little bit. She seems a little more human in this, as opposed to when he writes her in Alpha Flight, she's a little more... He's written as a, because she's an elder god or something.
Well, she's, especially in her Anne McKenzie
disguise, personality.
She just seems, exactly like an ordinary person would be. And the kind of things she says, like, when she's saying, "I hate those smarmy little bureaucrats," when they're talking about, she just seems like an ordinary human. Mind you, I think at this stage she was still supposed to be a mutant.
Exactly. I don't think he'd decided what she was
yet. Not altered that. Yeah. And then, of course, she changes into all these creatures, though that's the same, although we don't always get the background on how or why she can do that. She just does it.
Right, because I think in the we talked about in our coverage of 12121 that they were called mutants, so they considered that they were all mutants, and it's later whatever she is, she's some kind of a spirit that's tied to Canada. You can't leave Canada.
She's connected to, is it Hodiak? Is the Indian god. And something else, another connection with sort of a phrase, when she startles Nightcrawler as she's a Arctic bear.
A bear, yeah.
Polar bear. And then she just changes back to a woman. And he thinks, how does she do that? And then later in the story, when Wolverine tells Nightcrawler to do something, and he just bamfs out of it, and she's like, oh, Nightcrawler vanished, and she thinks, how does he do that? So they're both thinking about one another, and like, how do they do that? What's their powers? Exactly.
Well, that's all kind of played for last, because you've got that scene where Nightcrawler's hair literally stands on end.
Yeah.
And then he jumps on Wolverine, and you know, he's acting like he's all scared just because she's just a polar bear. But and I was thinking, is she, and I could not remember if the X-Men had run across Mystique yet, or surely he's run across other shape changers by now.
I don't think the X-Men had they. Mystique appears in
Days of Future Past.
So he may not have been.
She appears to the X-Men for the first time there, I think. She'd already made an appearance in something, I believe. I think it's Ms. Marvel, where she first appeared. She was disguised as Nick Fury, I think. But that was the first time they met her, was Days of Future Past. Yeah, because he thought then, is this some kind of relative?
Yeah. Well, it's...
you ask your mother...
because that's where that connection. is it in Ms. Marvel, or is it in an Avengers novel or issue that Rogue steals Ms. Marvel's powers?
That was Avengers Annual 10.
Avengers, that's what I thought.
Yeah. That was Avengers Annual 10. But in Days of Future Past, that's before Rogue, isn't it? I think.
Is it?
Yeah, I don't think Rogue is part of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants then.
Destiny, Raven, who am I missing?
Pyro. Pyro, Avalanche, Blob.
Blob, there we go. Those are the five. No, she's not in it yet.
No. Rogue, so the Avengers Annual comes after
as a
Days of
Middle
Future
Past. Pardon the expression. And it was only upon her joining the X-Men that she was de-aged into a attractive young woman, shall we say. I'm sorry.
Avengers Annual 10 is 1981, so it is a little beyond this.
It's just it's
like a few months later maybe. And according to Wiki, these two issues take place 2 weeks before Alpha Flight number one.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got an issue with that, but I wasn't going to mention it until we got onto Alpha Flight itself.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Again.
Yeah. Again. I'll save the rest for later.
We get my synopsis was a little short on it, but we get a couple pages of flashback of why they're of the Wendigo attacking this family. Presenting Wolverine with a Bigfoot print, you know, they've done a plaster cast.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I know what that is.
Yeah. And then he goes into his memory of fighting the Wendigo. But of course, the Hulk was there too. He takes on both of them. Yeah. Yeah. And in the end, the fight against the Hulk gets stopped by the people who are trying to control the whole mystic part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, my synopsis didn't mention that there was a woman was trying to cure either her husband or lover. Yes. Maria Cartier was trying to cure somebody of being the Wendigo by pulling the spirit out of him and putting it into Bruce Banner. And that goes haywire. And instead, a guy named Baptiste does
George,
ceremony.
George Baptiste. Yeah.
He brings it into himself and he becomes the Wendigo.
He's the Wendigo, yeah. Now
and the other guy is saved.
Yes.
I'm curious. In the flashbacks, we never get a good shot of the Wendigo's face, and I wonder if that has anything to do with the drawing style of the way.
Good point. Yeah, because when he was drawn in the first Hulk appearance, he didn't look quite like that.
Mm-mm.
He didn't have the like the thick mane of hair around his face that Byrne gives him. Yeah.
That's
So that's probably why.
That's Herb Trimpe, I think. Herb Trimpe
yes,
drew him
it
first
was
time.
Trim. Yeah, yeah. And there's an editor's note about it says preceding flashbacks courtesy of Hulk 162 was the first time the Wendigo appeared then. 162, and then the 180-181 is when Wolverine was in it.
I always loved when you did those footnotes. That was always so helpful as a kid to tell you what you were looking for.
Yeah, yeah. And it it made you look out, you know, go and look for the other stories.
Exactly, exactly.
Very good idea.
They don't do that anymore now.
Yeah,
I've always liked Burns Wendigo better than the way he was originally drawn. It's kind of the same with the way he draws Sasquatch versus how others draw Sasquatch. They don't quite get it right.
But how do you know that this is right? It's Burns' interpretation, but it's just that he's so damn good at just drawing everybody, and it looks so right.
It's the mane of hair. The hair that helps.
Yeah, yeah. After a while, when Bernard's been drawing just about everybody in the Marvel Universe, in nearly every case, I thought, you know, Burns' version of whoever is the best.
Yeah.
I just couldn't help it. They were so good. They made every other version look, you know, not quite so good. There were one or two exceptions, but for example, his early versions of Iron Man didn't necessarily impress me as much as, say, J.R. Junior's and Bob Layton's had done. But by the time we got to Avengers West Coast, he'd nailed it then, and it was a lot better. Yeah.
Well, when I think Iron Man, I think Bob Layton. That is my He was on it when I started reading it, and you know, you think there are artists that are made to draw certain characters.
And that's his, yeah.
It's his, true. Yeah.
I agree, yeah. Well, not so much Layton himself. He was usually the inker or finisher. Mm-hmm. Like J.R. Jr. and Bob Layton, I really liked. And then even when Mark Bright did it the second time, with Michelinie and Bob Layton, Layton's finishes still gave us the same look, which was very nice. Yeah, yeah.
Well, which is better than when JR started doing the Hulk, Iron Man on his own.
Right,
That's when he had changed his style.
Yeah,
all his stuff looked very bulky.
Chunky. I was going to say. Yeah, true.
My only other exception would be Nightcrawler, because he's probably my favorite X-Men, and I prefer Dave Cockrum just slightly, maybe by half a point more than Byrne.
Yeah, I guess there's not much in it for Nightcrawler. Yeah.
No.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But definitely Wolverine.
Yeah,
I think his Colossus is better. I mean, Cockrum's Colossus is pretty good because he designed that look.
Yeah.
Also, that Nightcrawler and Colossus were Cockrum's creation.
Yes.
He favored them. Mm-hmm. Favored character in the books was Nightcrawler until Byrne came on board. Then the favorite character became Logan and Wolverine, and you can feel that shift over time. It's pretty apparent who's getting center stage and who's getting the limelight. I'm not saying that's true in all cases, but I've read that.
It's kind of a Dr. Smith syndrome, the way Dr. Smith overtook Lost in Space.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be a guest character, and then he became basically the star of the show.
I have something else to add before we leave this issue. This is a little on the adult side, so kids, you want to go to the kitchen and get a right now? The adults are going to talk for a moment. At the bottom of the flashback page where they show the family's tent being ripped apart and little Tommy ran off into the bushes. Don't try that at home, kids. The very last panel shows Vindicator holding the large plaster cast. And he says, we saw no sign of Aline Parnell or the baby. Our best guess is that they were taken away by their assailant. We don't know if they're still alive. I kind of hope they aren't. This mold of the brute's foot should give you an idea why. You want to read between the lines here, folks? Or do you want to just keep going on? I think that was a subtlety that some people got. And I think a lot of readers went right past them, went right over their heads. But as our recent late lamented former President Trump used to say, oh, you know, people with little hands, you know what they say? I got no problem here. No problem in that department, I assure you. Mm-hmm. I think that's the implication that they're trying to draw. Look at the size of the print of Wendigo's foot, and you'll get
I didn't pick up on that, Kirk, but but I understand what you're...
Right.
What's later is Wolverine says they're probably still alive because he likes to eat fresh meat. Mm. So he's not going to kill them right away because he wants to, I guess, consume them while they're still alive.
Right.
And it's kind of horrific the way you see the father is grabbed, the silhouette outside the tent. And then later he's got...
Not sure. They're leaving it in shadows in the darkness. Mm-hmm. You don't know who's who here.
Yeah.
I thought that's that was intentional misdirection so that we see it from Tommy's point of view and not a lot of details. So he just runs from the monster, but he doesn't really know who the monster is. And we don't either yet.
Well, this is very, there's a movie called Grizzly. It's a horror movie, 77, that about a Colorado resort that's being terrorized by this giant grizzly bear. It's basically Jaws on land. And that's what you would find if you were doing this cinematically. You would have the silhouette. You'd be in a tent. You shoot it from in the tent. You see a silhouette because your imagination is going to be much scarier than whatever they're going to show you on screen. So that's kind of what Byrne's doing here. He's and he talks about that they don't even find. They think he was literally torn limb from limb. They think it was a bear at first. But then they checked everybody, and that's when Wolverine says, no, it's the Wendigo. I mentioned briefly in my synopsis, but this is Wolverine's new costume. This is the first time we see the brown and tan, brown and yellow costume he's really more famous for that Byrne designed because he didn't want him to be in the
Fang outfit.
The Fang outfit, and we pointed this out, that it's the same color scheme as the Fang outfit, but it's basically a variation of his old costume without the little ribbing claws and didn't have his little cowl ears were just constantly getting bigger and bigger as they would draw him on.
True.
Yeah. Syndrome. Look at the cup. He's miscolored. He's got the blues and the yellow.
I noticed that. Yep. That is wrong.
As long as we're speaking about the cover, I have a comment here. This is an homage, by the way, to Fantastic Four number, 17, I believe.
Wow.
Where the Dr. Doom, there are four Dooms for the Fantastic Four, and you see in each quadrant of that cover, you see each one Reed, Johnny, Sue, Ben.
Different
trap.
It's that kind of style. Yeah.
This is sort of somewhat of an homage to that. The other thing I point out is the blurb here that says, "Welcome to the X-Men. Hope you survive the experience." This is going to be repeated through the X-Men series ad nauseum. They do rogue joins. They do it when somebody else joins. It's a constant punchline for the cover as a new character joins.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, are we ready to any final words on this before we move on to Nigel's issue?
Yeah, just one thing. It's a nothing thing, really. But when we were recording the last show about this, I said that I thought that by this story, Vindicator had become Guardian. I was wrong. He's still Vindicator.
He's still Vindicator,
yeah. Right, so shall we move on to the second part of the story, which is...
Which is all the action going on.
Yeah, which is X-Men number 140, release date 16th of September 1980, cover date of December 1980. The price was 50 cents cover price, which surprised me a bit because when we were doing the last one about issue, it went up on issue 121 from 35 cents to 40 cents, didn't it? And now it's going up again to 50 cents.
Well,
so that didn't last long, did it? Whereas as I mentioned last time, when the price rise was 40 cents on 121, the British price did not alter at all and didn't alter until X-Men 134. So the price of 140 Britain was still 15p. Other works by John Byrne for December of 1980. We've got Captain America 252, which is the second half of the Cap story against Mr. Hyde and Batroc, called Cold Fire, I believe was the title of that. And also Marvel Team Up number 100. Byrne drew the second story that appeared in that, which was when Storm met T'Challa, Black Panther.
Oh.
It was about, I think it was about 11 pages or so story, little backup story.
I think Brian and I have covered that. We have covered that in something. I can't remember, but I think we have covered that story.
Yeah. And I wish I had kept my copy of Marvel Team for that reason. Now I had it, but because the main story was an FF story, I think, and it was drawn by Frank Miller, and I didn't really like the art, so it got the boot. But I wish I'd have held on to it for the Byrne story. Anyway, never mind. Right, the cover art on this issue, X-Men 140, of course, is John Byrne, Terry Austin, and Danny Crespi. And inside, writers Claremont and Byrne, of course, pencils by Byrne, inks by Terry Austin, colorist Glynis Wien, letterer Tom Orzechowski, not sure how you pronounce that, editor Louise Jones, and the editor-in-chief would be Jim Shooter, of course. And the title of this part of the story is just called Rage. Okay, the synopsis goes as follows. The issue opens with Colossus using his strength to rip a rotting tree stump out of the ground. Angel is flying around Xavier's school for gifted youngsters, and seeing Colossus, he flies down to speak with him. Professor X mentally summons Angel and asks him to join him, and then when he arrives, he asks for Angel's opinion on the new X-Men. Angel seems to feel okay with most of the characters, but he doesn't hide his feelings concerning Wolverine. He thinks that he's a dangerous psychopath with freaky claws, in inverted commas. Professor X reminds Angel that the purpose of the school is to cater to all mutants, no matter how rough they may appear on the outside. In Salem Center, Storm endures an uncomfortable encounter with an amorous pimp before stopping at Stevie Hunter's dance studio to pick up Kitty Pryde. She's surprised to see how closely Kitty and Stevie have become in so short a time, and shamefully admits to herself that she's growing jealous. Kitty phases into the passenger side of the car, and Storm scolds her for such a showy display of her powers in public. Kitty assures her that she checked to make sure no one was watching before she attempted her stunt. Meanwhile, in northern Canada, the Wendigo charges at Nightcrawler, forcing the X-Man to retreat further into the woods. The surrounding environment is too congested for Nightcrawler to risk blindly teleporting, so he avoids Wendigo's grasp by acrobatically flipping through the trees. The monster manages to latch onto him, however, and begins squeezing the life from his body. Nightcrawler has no choice but to teleport blind, and he transports himself several yards directly into the air, and then teleports again safely to the ground. The Wendigo catches up to him, however, and throws him hard against the side of a wood cabin. Inside the cabin, Vindicator, Wolverine, Shaman, and Snowbird are discussing their strategy on how to deal with the Wendigo. Wolverine hears the sound of Nightcrawler's body slamming against the side of the building and rushes outside. He finds Nightcrawler's unconscious form and the Wendigo brandishing a pickup truck as if it were a baseball bat. Vindicator flies outward from behind Wolverine and begins firing his laser blasts at the Wendigo. But the Wendigo easily bats him away. Wendigo throws the pickup truck, which explodes, creating a fire. He then takes off deeper into the woods. Shaman uses powder from his medicine pouch to put out the flames, while Snowbird and Wolverine begin chasing the Wendigo. They eventually track the monster back to its lair, where he has camper Eileen Parnell and her infant son trapped inside of a cave. He tells Snowbird to regroup with the others while he tackles the creature directly. Like his namesake, Wolverine dives on top of the Wendigo and begins voraciously slashing at him with his claws. The Wendigo has supernatural strength, however, and is able to continue fighting despite his injuries. He grabs Wolverine and begins smashing him against the side of a tree. Suddenly, Nightcrawler arrives and attacks the monster from behind, distracting it long enough to give Wolverine a chance to catch his breath. Snowbird returns with Vindicator and realizes that only brute savagery can possibly stop this menace. She transforms into an actual Wolverine and launches herself at the monster. She succeeds in bringing the Wendigo down, but the violent passions of her animal form have consumed her, and she's now completely feral. Wolverine softly approaches her and coaxes her down until she is tame enough to revert to her normal humanoid form. Shaman uses his magic to counteract the curse of the Wendigo. He cures the creature's condition, transforming him back into the human Georges Baptiste. Vindicator is faced with a difficult decision now. As a duly licensed agent of the Canadian government, he is forced to place Baptiste under arrest for the murders of the people he has attacked whilst he was in the form of the Wendigo. When Vindicator returns to Parliament, the Prime Minister informs him that the Ministry of Defence no longer maintains the budget to continue funding Department H. He tells him that he will allow him to keep his security status, but as of this moment, Alpha Flight is officially disbanded. Epilogue. in a maximum security prison in Deming, New Mexico, the evil mutant known as the Blob escapes from his prison cell. He refers to a mysterious contact who has invited him to join a new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. The end.
Nicely done.
That is the conclusion to the Wendigo affair. Oops, what did you think of that?
It's a, as you might say, it was a ripping tale. It was a lot of fun.
Ripping yarns, yes.
Ripping yarns, yes.
Quite exciting, action-packed. One thing the synopsis did not really cover in more detail was during the fight with the Wendigo. So I just wanted to kind of go back and mention that. As it said, yeah, the Wolverine attacks Wendigo in his usual way. It looks like he's going to sort of finish him off easily. But yeah, because the Wendigo is sort of a mystical beast, when Wolverine turns to looking after Mrs. Parnell and her infant, the Wendigo recovers pretty quickly and he chases them down again and comes up behind Wolverine. He catches him out because Wolverine says he dropped his guard. And so then Wendigo slams him around. A little bit of this reminds me of the way that the bad Goliath slammed around Hercules in the Avengers story, where the Brotherhood when he slammed around Hercules when they attacked Avengers HQ, he's got hold of him like a rag doll, and he's just slamming him onto the ground and then into the tree, really bashing him around. And also from the MCU, from the Avengers film, when Hulk gets hold of Loki in a similar way and just slams him up and down, which sort of puts him out of action. Vindicator comes in then and fires a few shots off at Wendigo, but yeah, Snowbird takes the form of a real Wolverine. But of course, Snowbird's power, whilst it allows her to change into animals, Canadian native animals, she can only create the creature in a man-sized way. She can turn into things that are bigger than herself. She can't turn into things that are smaller than herself. They only become man-sized. When she attacks the Wendigo as a Wolverine, it's like a giant-sized Wolverine.
Yeah, that was my only problem when I first read this story was that how could she do more damage than Wolverine with his adamantium claws?
Yeah, she's a man-sized Wolverine. But because she is a Wolverine, she's kind of, they say she's more vicious than even Wolverine would be, because she doesn't have that mental capacity to control her bloodlust.
Well, I always assumed she was more, because she is mystical in nature, that she was stronger than a normal Wolverine and was had heightened powers. That's why she's able to overcome the Wendigo, which is a great panel with her over. She's over the body of it. You've kind of see some blood dripping from it. And all you see are her eyes and her teeth.
So, that was how she was able to defeat him as a Wolverine, And then, of course, allowing for Shaman to then cast his spell on the Wendigo and turn him back to George Baptiste.
Yeah, which I thought was funny. He says, is my cure, is my nightmare over? And Vindicator goes, sorry, no, you're not. You're under arrest.
No, you're under arrest.
Which this is supposed to be the same, so this is a direct connection to the Hulk issue, that this is the same guy that turned himself into Wendigo. So he's been out there prancing around, killing people. This was a, and the Where's this scene? There's a scene where when Wolverine is just coming up on the Wendigo, they spy his lair, and you see some skeletons, like some bones around there. And Wolverine makes a comment that he looks like he's getting hungry, so he's going to basically eat this woman. Yeah. And there's a point where when Wolverine leaps at him, that he's got the woman, and it looks like he's fixing to take a chunk out of her leg.
Yeah, he's getting the leg ready to, like, yeah, a chicken leg. Yeah.
Exactly, he's fixed him.
He's getting ready to chomp into the leg, yes.
Yep.
Just as he dives in with the claws. Yep.
And that's when Wolverine goes at him.
That's a good... Yeah, four panel page where he attacks initially. Yeah, some nice drawing there. But of course, he just kind of overpower him.
Mm. Yeah, and the way he's drawn is you can't tell if the Wendigo is just instantly healing, because you don't see any blood. Wolverine is certainly slashing at him with his claws, or if he's supposed to be invulnerable. He just is just impervious to it. But it is later said that after Snowbird takes him out, but he says that his healing factor, he'll be fine in a couple hours.
Yeah.
You know, so he's already, so he does have
on with it because, he'll recover. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think in the flashback, in the previous issue, when he was remembering about fighting the Wendigo and the Hulk, I think he said something then about his claws were not kind of damaging him in the way that it would an ordinary person. You know, he wasn't ripping him apart. He wasn't really bleeding as such. His mystical power is kind of...
And apparently
gives him this instant healing ability, unless he's really, really ripped apart, which is what it seems Snowbird does in the form of the Wendigo.
Yeah. Well, they mentioned that he could be overcome by sheer force. That's what Wolverine and Hulk did earlier. It's what she says. So that's when she decides she has to change, and she goes at him. It's another great scene where, because she launches, you see him, it's like she attacks his face. She's launching right into his head.
Yeah.
Then you see the other characters looking on, horrified. And it's like, they say it's a.
This is another one of those panels, actually, where we see everybody else's reaction to a horrible scene. Yeah. Because it says what follows is not so much a battle as a clash of primal forces, a duel of fang and claw, muscle and sinew. And it's something that, all present will never forget. And they're all looking with, like, quite horrified faces. Oh, except Wolverine. He's saying, Annie, what have you done?
And I don't remember, when you get into Alpha Flight proper, was this ever brought up again about when she takes on a form, she runs the risk of losing herself in that form? I don't remember that ever really coming up. Maybe I'm misremembering.
I can't recall that. I'd have to look at them again. I've not read the Alpha Flights for a long time. I'm saving it, but it's possible she might mention it, but
maybe
I can't remember.
That's what we get. We talked about her being a mutant, but when she first transforms, she does call upon the spirit of the Northern Lights, grandfather, help me, give me strength. Mm-hmm. So that hints that she's not probably not a mutant. She's something else.
She's not just she's not just a simple mutant. There's something else, connected to the spiritual nature of everything. Yep.
What's my other notes? The notes on Nightcrawler getting attacked, and he is he teleports away, then the Wendigo crashes to the trees, and you get this great shot of Nightcrawler. Figure drawing of him just acrobatically jumping around, avoiding the Wendigo, but then the Wendigo backhands and sends him flying. Nightcrawler is not necessarily as far as I know, he has the same durability as a regular person. Yet he flies through the air to the cabin, and I don't know if he lands nearby and crawls up there, or if he lands, they hear a thump, and maybe that's him hitting the cabin. So I don't know how he could survive that. But
he's a bit more like a cat,
maybe
a person with regard to what they can, how they can they can sort of take a lot more punishment when falling and things like that. Yeah.
Well, he is flexible. So that could be
his
possible.
His body's more supple. Yeah. Flexible. So it just knocked him out. But again, some really nice artwork.
It's throughout this whole thing. Yeah.
Fabulous. And this is the issue which caused the final straw between Byrne and Claremont, isn't it?
Oh, the stump.
Colossus at the beginning pulling out the stump. Yeah.
We talked about on True Brit.
Although when I reread the narrative part again when I was looking at this just to see what it said. And really, it's not that bad. I think Byrne was kind of overreacting a bit.
Yeah, he's not straining, really.
Because, the way he drew Colossus, it was meant to be that it was no problem at all. And that he just yanks it out like it's easy, you know. So I thought, what did Claremont actually write? But it's not. It just says, Julie's an old friend with a tree stump. There's not really anything that suggests he's really having a bad time.
The only thing that I think that he might object, he says, by linen, either my heart will burst and my steel body crack.
Yeah.
But the way he's drawn, he doesn't look like he's struggling.
And that's it. Yeah, I think that's it. It's what he had him saying. If he'd have just left the speech bubble out,
I don't think Claremont likes quiet panels. He wants to fill it up with something. But this is it's a one pager, but it's a nice little scene with Peter and Angel, because Angel basically says, why are you doing this? And he gets a little back. We know that he came from Russia and he was a farmhand. He lived on a farm, and he says basically he likes to do this because it makes him feel kind of grounded. It makes him feel closer to the land, and that, in the big scheme of things, his power is nothing compared to Mother Nature. So you get to, and it, I like this, when he says, I'm sorry, I am not expressing my thoughts, my feelings. Well, I have not the voice, the words. And Angel says, Powell, Shakespeare couldn't have said it better. And it is. He says, Peter may be the most honest, honorable person I know. And that is, Peter has always been kind of the heart of the X-Men, because he is very honest and innocent and noble. And so that's why it's little, these little character bits that they're sprinkling in throughout even with the thing with Aurora and the pimp, that's just played kind of for laughs.
That's what made this title so good at that time. No doubt.
The first page where Wendigo was taking a swipe at Nightcrawler is that's gorgeous. That is just, it's a big top panel, and Nightcrawler's jumping out of the way. I even like the panel where he disappears. He bamps because Wendigo is reacting to it. He's reacting his prey has suddenly disappeared.
He gets hold of him and then poof.
To the Kirk, what'd you think?
I think we've lost Kirk.
No, I think he came back. Oh, he's back.
Yeah, computer locked up. Well, basically, I like this issue. And, the character bits are good. This is basically a fight issue. It does a lot to advance the relationships between the various characters, except I had a thought as we get to the last page with Vindicator talking to the Prime Minister. Just before that, Vindicator is shaking Wolverine's hand and saying, I know this seems cruel, but he has to face Canadian justice and what have you. Don't worry, Wolverine. Things are settled between us. We won't be coming after you. Department H won't be after your tail. Gee, that's a real turnaround, considering that he was taking orders from them the last time that we saw them. He suddenly, improved in stature. He seems to be taking on responsibility and making decisions to let Wolverine go. It could just as easily have gone the other way if he'd walked into Pierre Trudeau's office and been told, what do you think you're doing? You had Weapon X right in front of you. Why didn't you, you're fired. You're going the other way. But the thing that strikes me is as you read this and he discovers that the department has been closed or canceled, that they've been cut loose, it occurred to me that if they were all being portrayed as mutants, I wondered if maybe the possibility, the threat had been floated that Alpha Flight was going to become the next team of X-Men, that they were going to go to the school and say, we have no home. Can you use a few more mutants?
Or open a branch of Xavier's school in Canada. I mean,
that's possible.
Yeah,
I would think that the professor's response would be, sure, get into your school training uniforms and we'll join you in the danger room. He would have said, screw this. We're adults. We ain't going through those sessions.
Well, it's
out of my head.
In that last panel where Vindicator is walking away thanking the PM, it says, an ending of sorts, yet also a beginning of a new, possibly brighter chapter in the life of Alpha Flight. That sounds like they're hinting at, we want to put them in their own book, which would come 3 years later.
Well, I'm going to say that was something I'd got down to bring up, that very thing. I mean, this is the end of 1980 when we're reading this story, And Alpha Flight number one didn't come out until August 83.
Right.
So at this point, or when this was drawn and put together anyway, which would probably be around about August, September of 1980, had Marvel already decided they were going to do an Alpha Flight title? Or was this just a kind of wishful thinking kind of ending to write that, possibly a brighter chat? When did they decide they were going to do that? Because if it's hinting at another comic here, it took them a hell of a long time before the first issue came out, didn't it?
That might have been, I know the story is they were good. They went to Byrne and asked him to do it, and he didn't have any desire to do it. They basically said, well, we're going to do it with you or without you. And he thought, I better do it. If it's going to get done, maybe do it right.
Yeah.
So maybe that was what drug it out. I don't know how long it takes to.
I'm going to say, is that what caused the sort of time period? Because
could have been
after they first offered it to him and he said no, maybe they didn't immediately say to him, well, we're doing it anyway. I don't know. I would have thought they would have said that, though, if he refused or looked like he was going to refuse. They would have given him the ultimatum, if you like.
Right.
Well, if you don't do it, somebody else is doing it, but we're doing it. You know what I mean?
He had like right of first refusal. Like if you get to do it, if you don't, then we're going to let somebody else do it. But when did he, because this is Brooklyn, he left the X-Men, three issues later? Four issues later.
After the Kitty issue with the Christmas, that was it.
Yeah. After 144, he leaves.
But
he doesn't go directly to FF, does he?
FF.
Does he go directly kind of to FF?
I can't remember what month it came out. It was the following year, it was 81. Yeah. But when did he start?
He started, FF? 232?
Is that towards the end of that year or... I can't remember, but
I'm fixing to find out right now.
Realize is they may tell him, we want to do this book, but he needs some advance time to come up with stories, plot lines, characters.
He's
going to involve what the pacing is going to be. You don't do that overnight.
No.
So once they get finally to the point where he says, okay, look, I'll do it if you insist, then he has to start from scratch or basically scratch. Because we have, if you look at the historical record, we have Puck, we have Marina coming, we have all of Gamma Flight, we have Box, we have Madison Jeffries, we have Diamond Lil, we have all that backstory that has to be at least hinted at in the first issue.
Yeah.
So that doesn't come overnight. So I can
understand. He didn't have any. He took over FF in April 81. So about 6-8 months after he left X-Men, He was on FF. And I'm sure, to your point, Kirk, when you go to take over, you have to present probably 6 months of story to say, these are my story plans.
Right.
And then the editor has to go, oh, I like that. I do. Where would we go with this? And, well, I don't like that. Let's work on some more story concepts. Or what about think about another character? If it's a good editor, they're working, you know, hand in glove or shoulder to shoulder with the artist creator to come up with these ideas. If it's a bad editor, they just say, no, go back to the drawing board. And, you know, I think it's all in how, what your relationship is with your editor. I think they loved working with Jones, Wheezy Jones, who became Wheezy Simonson.
I just realized that when I was like, wait a minute, that's the same. Well, Simonson's wife, right? Yeah. They just weren't married at this point.
Working with her, both, as I understand it, both Roger Stern and John Byrne, probably because she treated them right and guided them when she had to. You know, Stern as an editor over top of Byrne apparently treated him right. I mean, there are people that click and we get good product from, and then there are others who may be 6-7 feet tall who try to hammer round this, you know, square holes. And you know, upset the apple cart. So I don't have anything for it. Where am I going with this? I don't know. But I'll tell you, the last page of this issue, "The Days of Future Past," I immediately recognized that as a line from the Moody Blues, which were all the rage at this time period, by the way, or slightly earlier than that, as having you know, Knights in White Satin and re-released their greatest hits LP in a double album. So that expression, which is a play on their album title, really, really rang bells with me. I was looking forward to whatever came. And my subscription kicks in next issue.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't buy anything prior to this, more is the pity. But I did see the annual that came out just 2 issues ago, just prior to the Wendigo storyline, A Nightcrawler's Inferno.
Yeah.
On by somebody else. I don't know who drew it. Was it Cock? And I just thought it was terrible. I saw it on the spinner rack and I flipped through it and I put it back because I couldn't figure out how it fit in the storyline, and it wasn't that good artist that I was coming to enjoy so much. Had it not been for that reaction, I might have started buying X-Men at that point. A couple of months
earlier. And you could have retired a rich man, right, Kirk?
Well, no, just buying them for my own pleasure. I've still got those floppies. They're sitting in the next room, bagged and boarded in the archives. But, you know, that's just my personal background. This is the point where I come on board and Byrne leaves. And I go, what are
I did that a lot. I did that a lot because I kind of did that with Daredevil with Frank Miller. I got the tail end of that. At the tail end of his Dark Knight story that had been coming out, and I picked up the final issue. You know, I came into I missed all of Byrne and X-Men. When I came in, it was J.R. Jr. was doing it.
Right.
But you know, you get on the X-Men, you know, Byrne's going to come up almost immediately, and you're going to have to go back and search out all the. I just wish I had the money at the time to fill in a lot of these when they were reasonably priced. But back when you're paying 60 cents for an issue, $5 for a back issue seems like a lot.
Right.
So,
by the way, I checked. You guys didn't hear me, but I was trying to interject when you were talking about the price increase. It happened with issue 138, just about 2 issues before.
Right.
40 cents to a double-sized 75-cent issue, and without any fanfare, it dropped back down to 50 and sat there. So the Wendigo issue first 50 cent issues, but they're the first ones that we have been covering in this series. So,
well, it's odd how they would some price ranges they would just kind of freeze at, like 35 cents was a forever, 50 cents. You know, when I was buying them, they had just gone from 60 to 75, and they were at 75 forever. And then I think for a while they went to like 90, and then he went jumped immediately to a dollar.
I think they were good. I don't remember them being 90 cents ever.
Maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's but sometimes they'll hover, and sometimes they'll be at a price not very long. Then it'll go to a, you know, it was like a dollar, Then they go to 125, then 150, 175, then I think 225 maybe.
My argument when they're doing that, the cost of printing and the cost of ink is not accelerating that fast. Inflation no. is a thing, but it doesn't accelerate that fast. So where is that money going? It's going into corporate coffers, number one, but then it's also going to the artists who have
it's going to talent, yeah.
and have commanded a higher price. So I can't complain too much when we're getting good artwork and good stories. But when they just start jumping arbitrarily, it would appear, every 25 cents every couple of months, and it just goes up with no end in sight, you see a lot of people leave the comic industry and leave, you know, buyers, fans, walk away and put away comic books as childish things. And now they're kicking themselves saying, oh, man, you know what those things are worth now? So, Tim, my recommendation is rather than trying to go back and get the individual issues, there are these wonderful things that that I'm going to hold up on camera for you here so that you can see. They're called Marvel Masterworks. They are 10 issues at a stretch. They are wonderful. They're your friend. You have to pay $75 for them to get 10 issues. But
Omnibuses are better. I've got the John Byrne X-Men Omnibus, which gives me 20, 25 issues. And if you look for them on the comic book site where I used to, where I was buying comics, I don't buy them now, Discount Comic Book Services. A lot of times when it would come out, they'd be half off. So you could get it for $60. And that's a giant tomb of a book.
And that's why I don't like them. They may reprint all the letters pages and have lots of added features. And they're a wonderful way to collect it all in one sitting. But have you tried to balance that on your leg while you're sitting in the
No, you can't. Well, they're oversized. It's larger than they originally came out. So
I would argue that if you can't find the Marvel Masterworks, paperback or hardbound, I'm thinking that the Epic line, am I saying that right? Epic.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Not Essentials, but the
Epics, yeah.
is the way to snag the great arcs.
I've got them all digitally. I can read them, and I only pick them up if they're reasonable. I don't, you know, if I can't get them reasonably cheap, I'll fill them in. But other than that, it's like, I'm not gonna go to my grave regretting like, oh, I wish I'd bought that one issue.
Not yet, you are. But
well, I got my giant size X-Men number one. I'll hold on to that. I picked that up at a con, and that's the highest price. I bought that probably 87, 88, and I paid $45 for it. And yeah, at that time it was like, wow.
Now you're paying $60 for an entire omnibus.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think I bet I could sell that for a couple thousand easily. You're talking about first Nightcrawler, first Colossus, first Storm, first Wolverine as an X-Men.
First Thunderbird.
Yeah. Now that you brought up Thunderbird, I read that when they were looking for names for Kitty, Claremont was upset that I guess somebody made him, maybe it was Shooter, kill off Thunderbird so early in the run. So he wanted to use that name for Kitty, and Byrne thought, well, that doesn't lend itself to her powers. Why would you do that?
Right, it doesn't.
No, well, but she's been team, what?
I've also read that they looked at the team and they said, oh, we have lots of good, unique individuals here that we can do a lot of stories with. But we have a berserker killer here, and we have a berserker warrior here. You know, the Wolverine and Thunderbird, gee, they seem to really mimic each other. You know, do we really need to? Which one do you want to kill off? That's how I heard they came to that. But also to alert the reader, hey, nothing is sacred here, you know. Just because we introduce a character doesn't mean he's going to stick around.
Well, there's a nice little bit at the end of this where when Vindicator is telling Wolverine that, you know, we have to arrest this guy because he's responsible for what he did.
Yes.
And Kurt asks Wolverine, well, you're a killer. Should you be responsible? He basically, his explanation is I've only killed in self-defense. Somebody comes at me, I don't use my claws unless they're coming at me and I'm either trying to save somebody or I'm trying to protect my life. But you could argue that, okay, I pull a gun on Wolverine. So he pops his claws and he kills me. Self-defense, right? But he knows that my gun is not going to kill him. because of his healing factor. He's not really in any danger.
Have they established the healing factor at this point?
I think so. Haven't they?
I don't know.
I don't know.
All the time into what we knew.
I think it's an article he wrote
where they went through all this and cited chapters of where we learned each individual piece of the Green Legend. And I don't remember who wrote that, but I'm sure on Facebook someplace. And it was interesting how much we have taken for granted now that was not set in stone when the character
exactly.
began. Well, listen, hours, guys, we should probably start wrapping up.
Yeah, I'm ready to kind of wrap it up. My last comment is on the last page where they are getting aboard this airship. I don't ever remember seeing this. This is Alpha Flight's hover ship, airship, whatever. And I always thought they flew something that was similar to a Quinjet. I don't remember seeing this vehicle before.
I don't think it continues, does it?
No, I don't. Yeah. I think this is the...
This was the Canadian RMPCs taking custody.
Maybe it's
the
government.
This is the only place, I think, where you see this. The sort of... The Quinjet-looking aircraft.
It's called an Omnijet, I think.
Comes from when they get their own title. Yeah.
Right. Because that's carried over into Elswin, doesn't he? That's when they have, at one point, the X-Men are in... Quinjet kind of vehicle.
And then they visit their Sentinel headquarters, don't
they? Yeah, that's what I was thinking in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kirk, why don't you tell folks where they can reach us?
Facebook is the fastest and the easiest way these days. Just look under Third Degree Burn because we're always interacting there, posting new graphics, teasing the new show, reacting to what people have told us. That's probably the best. However, you can also reach us via email by writing to gottagetburned@gmail.com. And I believe that, is it Tim or is it Brian who checks that account?
We both check it, but we've been lax. And if somebody's been writing us in, I will apologize that we have not really responded to any listener mail. I don't think we've had any lately, but if we have, then apologies, and we will eventually get those read. On a show.
Another way to get to us, I'm told, is formerly Apple Tunes, formerly iTunes. Now, what is it? Apple?
Help it's me Apple out. iTunes. I think it's called that's Apple right. iTunes or Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts. There you go. So that's a couple of different ways to get a hold of us. And then every so often, we'll post a poll asking you for your input about what you want us to do next. Are there any particular arcs or titles that you want us to cover? Or is there one shot that we've overlooked that we ought to be including? So give us your feedback.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on. Again, it's always a pleasure to record you guys. And for our listeners, the next time we head to the Great White North, we will be covering Alpha Flight issue number one. So for Third Degree Burn, I am Tim Elliott.
I'm Kirk Greenfield.
And I'm Nigel Spink.
Thanks for your work, Nigel. You do a really fine summary, by the way.
Thank you.
Rescue Kitty from the cave.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.